who finds himself drowning in a bucket of cream has two choices. Drown, or fight so hard he churns that cream into butter.
Jimmy Graham goes down hard!
And simply climbs out.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you for rejoining us. If you missed any of the last segment, we had an extended interview with our first guest, Eva Bartlett, who just came back from Syria. Great discussion, a lot of information there. In fact, a lot of important information. If you missed any of the live broadcast, you can listen to the podcast after the show. We'll have that available on download right after the show, and that will be up on the iTunes platform as well later this evening for the podcasting community. But really great segment by Eva Bartlett. Now, one of the issues that we haven't given enough coverage to, because we're a small operation, because we don't have bureaus and people sitting on desks dealing with certain stories, is the issue of Palestine. And the reason I haven't covered it is, one of the reasons is, sometimes it's challenging to find people that are very much dedicated to that issue, that are available, that we can squeeze in. Obviously, we're focusing a lot on Syria because it's very important and it's pivotal. But nonetheless, not any less important is the issue of Palestine, which is happening not too far south of Syria there. So to help us on this, we're joined by our next guest. He is an independent journalist. He's also a very strong advocate for the issue of Palestine. His name is Robert Inlakesh, and he's joining us on the live link from the UK. Normally, he would be joining us probably from Canada, but he is on the move at the moment. But hello, Robert.
Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Thank you so much. And also thank you for your great live stream broadcasts to camera, which you're doing on social media, and some of the videos you put out. Really strong opinions and a lot of great information. So everyone, a lot of people out there really appreciate your work there, Robert. And so right now, I just want you to introduce yourself to our listeners, but also just explain what has happened in Palestine over the last couple of months, how this is built up, and why it's significant. But go ahead, Robert.
Well, like you've introduced me before, I'm an independent journalist. I've spent some time on the ground in Palestine, in the West Bank in particular. I just came back from 3 months in the West Bank. I have a lot of contacts there, and I've dedicated a lot of time to understanding what's going on there and reporting on what's going on there. I report for Al Masdar News, so for what's going on, updates on Palestine. So I'm pretty much covering almost everything that's going on there, and I hear from people on the ground, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, about what's going on. But I suppose there's always things going on in Palestine, but the most, I suppose, pertinent thing that we need to talk about now is the past 7 weeks of what's been deemed the Great Return March, which is, it started on the 30th of March, and every single Friday, Palestinians have been going in their largest numbers, of course, throughout the week. They've been there protesting at the borders, but on the Fridays in their largest numbers, and they've been demonstrating quite creatively. No Israelis have been injured nor killed. And the Israelis' response to this peaceful demonstration, which is in line with international law, the Palestinians quoting the UN Resolution 194 in order to, is basically, it talks about the Palestinian right of return. And the Palestinians also are requesting the end of the ongoing, going into its 12-year illegal besiegement of the Strip. The Israeli response to that has been to set up snipers along the border on behind dirt mounds, sitting behind several security fences and barbed wire strips, and pick off shots at now 9,000 demonstrators have been injured in some form, whether it's been by tear gas, live ammunition, some rubber bullets have been used, explosive bullets, and also artillery strikes. And this is on peaceful demonstrators. So right now, 52 people have been killed, peaceful demonstrators, since the March the 30th in a peaceful demonstration. And this Friday, I suppose, was another one of the escalations in the number of dead and also the number of injured in this demonstration, where 731 people were injured. This has been one of the lightest Fridays for those injured, but 146 people were shot with live ammunition. So 146 people who came out to a border to demonstrate peacefully were shot with live ammunition for doing that. And it's a really, really disgusting state of affairs. Also, yesterday, I'd just like to quickly add in, there were airstrikes conducted, as there is regularly, on the Gaza Strip. But these ones were conducted on Beit Hanun. And in particular, they targeted what they called a Hamas terror tunnel, even though the so-called terror tunnels have never targeted a civilian, so they can't call them that. And they targeted an electricity plant. So to try and put on the decline the electrical supplies of the people in that area, which is in the north of the Gaza Strip.
Wow. So let me just rewind a little bit. The uproar in the international community, I'm sure you're aware of this, Robert, as we spoke to Eva Bartlett just a few minutes ago about this, the uproar, the whole basis of the sanctions against Syria, the outrage, the policy to back the opposition, to arm the opposition, is all based on this narrative that there were peaceful protesters in Daraa and that they were brutally put down by the evil, brutal butcher Bashar al-Assad. That's the narrative. So that was the sort of the catalyst for what we see now in terms of Western intervention. And what you're describing to me, Robert, is actual peaceful protesters, because as we learned from Eva and other journalists in Daraa, they were burning down buildings, they were shooting police, they were stabbing people, they were even shooting other protesters to blame it on the army, the Syrian army. What you're describing, Robert, is an actual peaceful protest where they are actually getting shot by the IDF, by the Israeli military, unarmed protesters. So I'm just thinking, where is the international outrage for this story, Robert?
It's funny you say that and you bring up sort of the double standards that are used. You know, oh, well, their narrative, of course, with Syria, like you said, is, oh, there were peaceful demonstrators and they started getting shot down. Well, the evidence for that is very slim. In fact, it's on the contrary, as Eva, of course, has explained in some detail in the past, and I'm sure on your show, and others have explained. But with this, like you've just mentioned, this is a peaceful demonstration. And not only are we just alleging this, or the hospitals are giving these numbers, we have live streams from every single angle all day in Gaza showing us what's happening so incredibly blatantly. And still, somehow, this international community, which claims to care about human rights and claims to want to intervene when it's in Syria, and also, I turn to the likes of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. These types will use the sort of wording when it comes to Palestinians being killed as they just died. You know, like the mainstream media will say, for instance, they just died. Oh, you know, today, 15 Palestinians, they died. Like, let's not tell anybody about how they died. They just died. They just decided to roll over and die. But the Human Rights Watch, they said that Israel used disproportionate force. Why are they permitted to use any force whatsoever against peaceful demonstrators? In what world, in what sane world, are they used to, do they have any right to use deadly force or any force against peaceful demonstrators? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And all of them are cowards. when it comes to this issue. They won't speak up against the state of Israel because they saw what happened to the likes of Richard Goldstone, who produced the Goldstone Report for the United Nations. This man was a Zionist, and they destroyed him. They were blackmailing him, and they made him into like Satan in the state of Israel, just for saying that during one of the bombardments of the Gaza Strip that Israel were acting and behaving in a criminal manner and killing children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it is extraordinary. Not only that, Robert, you know, any politicians that speak up against this, or at least in the UK, are currently being branded as anti-Semites. I can point to Jeremy Corbyn as a perfect example there. So it's gotten to the point in the West where any criticism of the policies or actions of this state of Israel and its military against the occupied territories and the residents there, the Palestinians, this is being categorized and characterized as anti-Semitism and therefore somehow forbidden in terms of public discourse. That seems to be the current trajectory of it. I realize these things go in waves and cycles, and that might not be the case next year or the year after, but certainly there is a very powerful lobby, and the media, with Rupert Murdoch probably leading the charge on that, his media empire is really sort of intimidating, harassing, attacking politicians or anybody that's basically speaking up about this. But in terms of the purpose of these demonstrations, explain the right of return, or explain what this symbolizes and how important it is.
Well, 70%, just to give you a bit of a description of the demographic of the Gaza Strip, over 70%, I'd probably lean towards 80% of the Gaza Strip are not from that area originally. They were expelled from that area either in 1948 or later in 1967 or in other times. And these people want to return to their homes. They're living in refugee camps. Of course, we call them refugee camps, but they've been able to, you know, build it up and have buildings there and proper houses and stuff now. But these people are misplaced. It's not their original home. You know, it's not their villages that they belong to in Gaza. They've been forced by the Israelis from their homes, from their homelands. You know, many of these people still have their keys to their homes, their deeds to their homes. And they're asking, under the United Nations Resolution 194, which called upon them to have their right to return, and it's completely legal, of course, under international law, but Israel, just to give you a bit of a feel for what's on the Israeli side, Israel will allow anybody who can prove that they have a Jewish ancestor, they will allow any of them their return right, supposed return right to what they call the state of Israel. When a Palestinian who is living either in, whether it be Lebanon or in Jordan or in the Gaza Strip or anywhere else, who has the deeds to their homes that they were expelled from, who are living in refugee camps, some in their own country, even in the West Bank, there's refugee camps that I visited where people are being brutalized on the daily. They want their right to return home to their homelands. They want to live dignified lives. And they have every single right. And I don't want to try and say that, this is the only way they should resist, you know, in a peaceful manner. They have every right under international law to fight that occupation force, but they don't even choose to do that. You know, these people are not picking up guns and going to the border and shooting and firing at Israeli troops. They're trying to scream out and demand, look, this is the framework provided by the international community, the same UN which created the state of Israel. And here, please allow us, you know, or please at least recognize what we're doing. But they neglect them completely. It's like they don't exist. And if the Israelis massacre a huge amount of Palestinians, then the mainstream media has to touch on it. But the language that they use is so perverted. The people, and even if you talk to people, you go, they don't report on it. And people might say to you in society, well, I saw it on the news. But what did you see on the news? You know, there were clashes. How do peaceful demonstrators with flags clash with Israeli snipers sitting with the newest military equipment on the other side of a border behind dirt mounds, sitting there like cowards and picking shots off at people. How's it a clash? It's not a clash. You know, the language that's used is so perverted. It's this 1984 sort of language that we're used. Like, they perverted the language to such an extent where you can't empathize with the Palestinians when you hear about their dead. And they're just numbers. They're not people. We don't hear about the personal stories. They don't make a deal of them shooting and killing journalists like they have, or shooting and killing medics and children. A 15-year-old child was shot 3 weeks ago in the head on video, through the head, a 15-year-old child, unarmed, at the border. Where was the international outcry for that? Can you imagine if that was an Israeli child? Imagine one Israeli person shot through the head on video by a Palestinian. I mean, you might have the United States pushing troops in there or something. It would be insane, the response.
What's amazing, Robert, is you think of the force that's being put to bear on Syria over the last 7 years. I have yet to see that video of a Syrian soldier, you know, shooting a peaceful protester. You know, the amount of stuff that we've seen. I saw a video from, I think it was through, it was either filmed by a camera. I know there was this one case where the IDF soldier were celebrating after they shot this one poor young man. But, you know, someone's just walking along and all of a sudden they drop, like, you know, the legs come from out from under them because they've just been shot. Either doesn't matter if it's by a rubber bullet or real ammunition. But there's so much evidence, Robert, but you're so right, that the coverage is completely selective. The language is completely biased and contorted. You know, and it is a level of propaganda that is, I mean, we talked about this early in the opening of the show, Robert. There's two countries that really don't have to abide by international law. You described how Palestinians are trying to work through the international system, as imperfect and flawed as it is, trying to at least show good faith with regards to, you know, international agreements and trying to play by the rules, as they say. But the United States and Israel are exempt from international laws, but yet the U.S. and Britain preach about norms constantly, about the rules-based international system, but it seems to me like some countries are exempt from this system, but they expect the 99% of the rest of the world to abide by it. It's kind of obvious, I guess, to people that are really looking at it, but I think that we have a real serious breakdown in the international system. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's interesting how you brought up how they always quote international law and they talk about it and they talk about how everybody else has to abide by it. And also, again, bringing up the example of Syria and how they try and quote international laws to Syria and accuse them of things, of breaking international law when they don't. I mean, the United States and Israel have dropped the likes of white phosphorus, different types of incendiary munitions, and the likes of depleted uranium on civilian populations all over the world. We know that. But even with Israel, it's violated more UN resolutions than any other nation state in the entirety of the planet ever combined. It's violated more. And always goes, oh, the UN pick on us. We don't like the UN. The UN are illegitimate. That's what Israel will say. But then when it comes to another country, suddenly it's legitimate. But again, like with them, who made them? Who created them? Who created the mandate for them to come into existence? Well, that was the United Nations. That gave 55% of the land or 56% of the land to 33% of the newly immigrated Jewish population. That's what the United Nations did. It gave them their state. But now it wants to say, well, it doesn't really matter and apply to us. You know, it's who's got the most force, and the United States and Israel have a lot of force. Really, Israel has an air force. It doesn't have a ground force. The ground force, they're a bunch of kids that come out of high school. They can't even fight the likes of Hamas on the ground. The Qassam Brigade, which is the fighting wing of Hamas, the militant wing of Hamas, whenever it fights the Israeli army in ground confrontations, it always wins and gets the better of them. But the Israelis have this strong air force, and they can go doing whatever they want because, you know, daddy, the United States, will come and back them up at whatever troubles they get into. I mean, it's completely disgraceful. They try and quote international law when it comes to other countries, but if it comes to them, oh, suddenly it's, you know, you're being anti-Semitic. You're anti-Semitic. That's what it is. You know, you're unpatriotic. That's why you're questioning us. You don't love your country, you know, or you hate the Jews, and that's why you're talking about this. But for every other country, it's held to this, you know, angel status.
Yes, and let's just talk about the bull in the China shop for a minute. I don't know if you saw this presentation that was on television or the video presentation of it. It reminded me of a one-man show off Broadway, Robert. It was Bibi Netanyahu with some filing cabinets behind a shower curtain, and he pulls back the curtain for the big reveal, and it's a bunch of binders from Kinko's all lined up nicely. And I thought, what sort of a comic act are we looking at here? And apparently this was the proof that Iran has a nuclear weapons arsenal or a program or something like this. And this comes just days before Donald Trump announces he's basically deep-sixing the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. And I'm looking at this very strange coordination between Tel Aviv and Washington in terms of timing. And then the third thing that happens, which kind of brings it all into perspective, is this reports just a few days ago that Iran had fired rockets from Syria into Israel. Israel has retaliated with massive missile strikes against Syria to, I don't know, 40-some targets. Some of those were taken down by air defenses in Syria. But nonetheless, the narrative is Iran has now brought the war to Israel. And I've been looking for days, Robert, looking for some proof that Iran has fired rockets into Israel to provoke this retaliation and the counter strikes that came after that. I still, Robert, can't find anything yet. This is what all the headlines said the day of. The Times, The Guardian, everybody. It was Iran fires rockets into Israel. The CNN was at it as well, as usual. What do you know about this story? Have you been looking at this?
Yeah, I've been following this. I mean, like you said, they started off with, they neatly packaged their garbage. It's still laughable, but they neatly package it. Netanyahu stood up and revealed his high school yearbooks and his old school porn CDs and played a whole bunch of old videos, which is a bunch of nothing. All the experts confirmed that it's a bunch of nothing, which are old files, which everybody's already seen. Of course, then Trump gets up, capitulates to Israel, bends over and follows his motto, which is Israel first, not America first. I think he got that word America and Israel. It gets them mixed up a lot. But with this whole Iran bombing, they bombed in the Jalan, and that's what provoked it. Of course, we know Israel struck Syria first, and then Syria responded. But even look back to 1967, the start of the Six-Day War. They'll still lie to you right now on the television and tell you that Egypt started the war. Or even I heard Alan Dershowitz try to claim that Jordan attacked Israel, which provoked the 1967 war. And even back then, they were the ones, and it's all on record, and this happened in 1967, they still lie about it, they were the ones to attack Egypt, wiping out their air force, knowing fully well that after they moved their those peacekeeping forces out of the Sinai, that they couldn't develop their army for 2 years, and they were at a war with Yemen. They were not capable of defending themselves. They went, bombed them, took all of this land over illegally. You can't acquire any land legally by war. You had to acquire it by diplomacy. Then in this 1967 war, the reason why I use it as an example is when they took over the area which was fired upon by Syria called the Golan Heights. And the Golan Heights is internationally recognized as part of Syria. It's illegally occupied still, but nobody's done anything about it because, of course, you know, like you said earlier, the United States and Israel and the likes of them, you know, the UK, France, whoever it may be, aren't held to the same standard that the rest of the world is held to. So we've seen in this recent incident where they claimed Iran fired rockets, and they're still claiming it. Like you said, it's a bunch of nonsense. But we saw in this recent incident that Syria finally responded. It fired through artillery at the Jolan, targeted, I believe, 10. I believe it's 10 different military sites within the Jolan. We got reports in that around 30 Israeli soldiers were transported to hospitals. And I suspect, this is not confirmed, but I suspect that maybe there were soldiers killed as well in those strikes. If you got that sheer number of people going from military sites into hospital, perhaps there are people killed as well that they hide from us. That's not confirmed. That's my own opinion. But then we saw them in so-called retaliation to this, them, Syria, retaliating for Israel's strikes, not only just then, but in the weeks prior, it was bombing Syria time and time again, targeting places south of Damascus and other different sites, also using SDF-held territory to target homes, a weapons storage facility in Homs and also in Aleppo. We saw Syria finally respond, and then Israel bombarded multiple sites throughout the country, then claimed, Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister of Israel, claimed that they eliminated most of Iran's infrastructure in Syria, which is nonsense because the sites that they struck were not where the majority of Iran's infrastructure is. The majority of Iran's infrastructure and the majority of where they operate, it's all in the east, and it's not even where they were striking. They were striking primarily in near bordering the Jolan, and they struck towards Damascus. So everything they're saying about this, everything they're claiming, is lies. And we know Israel has been striking. In 2016, there were reports put out, and Israeli ministers admitted this, that they had launched 100 strategic strikes against Syrian Arab Army positions in 2016. So they've never not been involved. Like, the BBC put out a report saying Israel has sat on the sideline and hasn't done anything. And on top of this, they've been treating these terrorists from the border, the region bordering the Jolan, which they illegally occupy, terrorists in the Jolan Heights, in hospitals. And we have video evidence of this. This is not just conspiracy theory nonsense. We have video evidence of this. And I'd like to ask people if they think this is all, like, too much for them to handle. Look at a map of the Syrian war, of the proxy war on Syria, sorry. And look at the area bordering the Jolan Heights, which is illegally occupied by Israel. You will see that ISIS and Al-Qaeda forces are operating on the border, and Israel never strikes these forces, never. So if it claims to fight terrorism and it claims to be against these people, why is it striking the sovereign government and its forces and not striking ISIS and Al-Qaeda? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Robert. I'm looking at a UN report right now. This is from the UNDOF, the peacekeeping force that was there before they were driven out by the moderate terrorists. And so this is from their report that IDF soldiers and rebels crossing over from the Bravo side, I think that's the Syrian side, to the Alpha side, which is where the Israeli forces are, talking with IDF forces across the ceasefire line, bringing vehicles, including two trucks, crossing from the Bravo side to the Alpha side, where they were received by IDF personnel. Okay, this is all documented by the United Nations in 2015. And the trucks were loaded with sacks. And then before returning to Bravo side, on at least four occasions, UN personnel at the observation post saw 54 vehicles, including small trucks, crossing the ceasefire line and then approaching the technical fence, which is, I believe, put up by Israel along part of that area there in the Jolan, or the Golan, as Americans will say. So the United Nations has observed this. This is documented. This was presented to the UN in 2015. And this was acknowledged in one of the Israeli newspapers at the time. What we're saying, Robert, here is this is very, very well documented. These aren't theories. There's incredible coordination between the Israeli forces and a number of rebel groups, including Jabhat al-Nusra. They are doing medical triage, providing that service for these terrorists. And ISIS are dotted right along the border, as you said, Robert. These are all facts. So the question then, Robert, is Israel really fighting terrorism?
Or it is a terrorist state.
Well, go ahead.
It is a terrorist state, even if we look at its foundation. The Israeli military, if you look at the symbol for the IDF, it came directly out of, and they used the same symbol that they used for the Haganah. The Haganah, for the establishment of the so-called State of Israel in 1948, was designated by the British as a terrorist organization because of them carrying out bombing campaigns. The likes of the Stern Gang, the Lehi, the Haganah, and others were ruled by the British as terrorist organizations, and they later, members of all these terrorist organizations, then went into becoming the Israeli government. And this sort of ideology has never changed. They've always been executing civilians. They've always been heisting more land. They're consistently doing it. Just things that I witnessed. I witnessed them shutting down roads, shooting gas at children, coming in, throwing sound grenades into my friends' houses at night, shooting tear gas into their homes at night. I was almost shot with a rubber bullet, was right past my shoulder for participating in a demonstration. I mean, like, I've seen them brutalize children, and that's just what I've seen. And that's just everyday life that you walk and stroll upon. You get tear gassed every other day if you're in places like Hebron in the West Bank. They operate as a terrorist state. They are a terrorist state. And then they accuse others of being terrorists. I mean, personally, it's my belief that all of these groups work really for the aims of Israel, whether they do it knowingly and willingly, or whether they don't do it willingly, because Israel want to destabilize, balkanize, and pretty much just take over the entirety of the region there. And they've had a plan for a long time to do this, and they continue to strive for it, even though it's absolutely psychopathic. I mean, they don't have the population to do such a thing as take over the Middle East. I mean, it's an insane thing. They're crazy. But they act as terrorists, even if you want to talk about the bombings of hotels, hijacking planes. They hijacked a Syrian airliner in the 1950s. Before any Palestinian had hijacked a plane, they hijacked planes. Before any Palestinian had blown up a cafe, they blew up cafes. Before any Palestinian had blown up themselves in a car or a bus, they had blown themselves up in cars and buses. And not only that, but they were gunning down ships of Holocaust survivors, which were trying to flee and go back to Europe. This is all on record. This is all documented. Since their foundation, they've been a terrorist state. And they operate on the same ideology as ISIS. We want a state that is strictly ruled by one group of people who agree specifically with exactly what we want. And anybody else who disagrees with us has to be killed, has to be subjected to the most brutal forms of harassment, torture. And Israel has been doing this for 70 years. I mean, people go on about all different regimes all over the world and you know, how bad. They like to refer back Israel, of course, to the Nazis a lot. Well, of course, they did deals with the Nazis back in the day. We know that they had a transfer agreement, not to say that Nazis and Zionists were best friends. That's not true. But there was a deal that took place between them. But Israel had been operating like this for 70 years. Nazi Germany didn't last that long. I mean, ISIS, they're already destroyed. They haven't lasted that long. I mean, these are terrible groups and terrible regimes. But they're not like Israel. It sustained itself. And still, people still see it with this sort of view that it's some sort of liberal democracy. I mean, it's ethnocracy. Even if you're a Jewish person of Middle Eastern or Ethiopian descent, I mean, Ethiopian children are being sent to different schools. Ethiopian Jewish children are being sent to different schools than other Jewish children because the white Jews don't want to have them in their schools. This is the sort of thing that's going on in the state of Israel. And not even just against Palestinians, not just against Arabs, Christians, and Muslims, against Jewish people as well included.
Yeah.
They're insane.
Yeah, well, look, I'm just looking at this story here. This was in Middle East Monitor. Israeli settlers flood Palestinian farmland with sewage. So this is under the sort of protection of the IDF. Of course, that's I'm sure you can attest to that, that certain people are literally allowed to get away with some of the most heinous crimes right in full view of the Israeli armed defense forces there, who are basically facilitating this. So you could say that's terrorism against Palestinians. I know it's very well documented over the years. There's no shortage of examples here. This incident, I think, is near on the outskirts of Hebron, which I'm told if you go to Hebron, I don't know if you've been there or not, Robert, but mm-hmm. in certain parts of Hebron, they have chicken. The Palestinians are down on the lower ground. They have chicken wire over the narrow streets because the settlers at the top are throwing their garbage and other things, which I won't mention on this show, throwing them down onto the Palestinians, dumping them. So they had to put chicken wire up in parts of Hebron. I mean, I'm sure you've got lots of stories like this, Robert.
Yeah, when I was there, there's a road which is called Shuhada Street, and it's closed. It used to be the main street, basically, for Palestinian businesses and different, it was very, very lively. And then these Jewish settlers came in there. They took over the street and shut it down. And this is where I say to people, if you want to see the apartheid at its most apparent, go to Hebron. You'll see roads where Muslims can't walk. If you tell them that you're Muslim, they won't let you walk down certain roads and streets. You had to go through multiple checkpoints just to get into a mosque and pray. And they took over a mosque, the Ibrahimi Mosque, which I went into. You'll go and they put bulletproof glass over. There's 30% of that mosque is now a mosque, and 70% is a synagogue because they took it over. And in between, to split this who sides up, there's bulletproof glass because, after the Palestinians have gone through two checkpoints, gone past armed guards, and walked through being humiliated to go into this mosque and just pray, then somehow we've got to assume that they'd also, pull a gun that they've keistered or something out and kill some Jews because they're all violent and horrible. I saw them there, locked down streets so many times, I can't even count it. The first day I was there, I saw them arrest three children. I was tear gassed. They locked down a road the second day I was there, and a woman, an older woman, I think she was trying to walk with her grandchildren or whatever it was, they wanted to walk past through this roadblock. They were walking through, and she wanted to walk with them because, these kids didn't want to walk alone, all these soldiers, it was very scary. And all these soldiers gathered around her, pulled her hijab off of her, pushed her to the ground, and the children were there, and they were pushing away the children violently. I mean, these are the sort of things that go on every day. They're invading my friends' homes. I'd stayed in the home of a friend of mine in Hebron whilst I was there. And the next time I came back, 2 weeks later, his brother had been arrested, and they burst in and they destroyed everything. And it wrecked up and he'd had to rebuild. And he was living in not the best of surroundings either. I mean, the harassment is constant. The settlers will attack and kill you. I've been followed with settlers with Uzis that are trying to intimidate me. The kids will run up to you with sticks and hit you because you're not Jewish. It's insane. All these checkpoints around the city, constantly firing rubber bullets at children. And I do mean children. Children might throw the odd stone at a soldier. They'll lock down roads and start shooting gas. And they'll go and they'll just arrest random people, pull them out and put them in prison. Right now I know 10 people which are in Israeli military prisons. A friend of mine that I stayed in his house for a month, and I slept in the same room as his son, who was just arrested last year on December the 10th. He stayed 6 months in administrative detention, held without a charge, him and his two friends, after being brutally ambushed by Israelis. He was 17 years old, spent his 18th birthday in an Israeli military prison, offered military prison. And then they've just, a few weeks ago, they they sentenced him to 19 months in prison for throwing stones. And this, his name is Abdul Khalik Burnett, the son of a very popular Bilayn activist in the West Bank. And he'd been shot in the head earlier that year, 2017, with what they call a sponge bullet, which is basically a big, thick canister on the back, a metal canister. It spins, and there's a little bit of rubber on the front. That spun, hit him in the back of the head, cracked his skull open. And then they thought, oh, well, a month or so after that, we'll arrest him whilst he's still recovering and he's still having to lay down and take his medication because of his head wound. We're going to arrest him and brutalize him and deprive him of his medicine. Also, his brother was shot through the leg in 2014 with live ammunition, almost bled to death. His 15-year-old brother now, Mohammed, has been shot, I think, four times with rubber bullets in the past. It's disgusting. It's disgraceful. And his 15-year-old brother has been arrested too. Like this is, these are just some stories, you know, like these are just everyday things for Palestinians. You know, soldiers come in, shoot gas into your house at night, 2 o'clock in the morning. They'll arrest your children. They'll smash up your home. They'll bulldoze your house in Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank. There's free areas in the West Bank. Area C, you don't have a water supply because that's banned, but the settlers get the water. You don't have electricity because, you know, all these brutal, these horrible, savage Palestinians, they can't have electricity, you know. I could go on all day. It's absolutely disgraceful, and there's ongoing ethnic cleansing. And I think I lost my original point.
No, that's okay. I mean, if you compiled it, you're talking about volumes and volumes and volumes of crimes and reports that you could, if it was a lawful society, that would have to be, you know, investigated and people held to account and so forth. But that's not happening because it is kind of a lawless society, or at least it's a giant open prison, as some people have described it. But just to wrap it up, coming to the end of the segment, Robert, you know, going forward, and I know you've expressed your thoughts, publicly on this issue. It's a very difficult issue. Is, you know, there's a lot of big problems with the Palestinian issue that it's not getting resolved, as time goes by, but yet people still have hope, yet we see what's happened over the last 7 weeks, and it's very inspirational. And we've seen this issue again rising to the surface, and we've seen people from all over the world taking an interest again in this issue after, you know, Syria has dominated the headlines for the last 7 years, and rightfully so. But a lot of it has to do with how much headline space there is and how much attention people are giving to various issues. I could talk about Yemen as well. That's another one that's been more or less airbrushed. But Palestine and the issue of Israel is stuck in a kind of a stalemate. And there's a lot of problems as well with the kind of co-opting of the activists who converge on Palestine, which you've talked about. And there's problems with this as well, where people in the West or even people in Israel wanting to make decisions for the Palestinians is what's good for them, basically. What are your final thoughts on this going forward? What do you see any important developments happening, or what do you think needs to start happening to get on the right path?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people that think that they are the ones to tell the Palestinians what to do. There's a lot of people in disillusion about how this what they call a conflict, what I call an ongoing oppression and colonization project. There's a lot of misconceptions about how it's going to come to a close, and also what Palestinians want and feel, and also that we can't determine this for them. I mean, you talked about just then that, you know, Syria's been in the headlines a lot, and it's taking up a lot of space. And people, when it comes to Palestine, they might support Palestinians, you know, and they're, you know, when they're a victim, but then they won't support their right to rise up and fight against their oppressors. And all these struggles in the Middle East are connected. I mean, this first spark of Arab sort of nationalism, which came about, and supposed rebellion against the British and also the Zionist entity, which was later to come, was inspired by a man named Qasem. And he was a Syrian and started leading the revolts against the British and against the Zionist settlers. And to that day, to this day, throughout the Middle East, Palestine is probably the most, it's at the heart of almost every single Arab. And there's a reason for that. And it continues to inspire people. But how it comes to a close, I personally think, and I see the demographic of Palestinians growing, Israel being completely overwhelmed. Also, the Israeli Jewish population is growing. The Middle Eastern Jewish population is growing and growing. White Jews don't seem to have as many babies as Middle Eastern Jews. And sooner or later, we're going to have a situation already in the state of Palestine in Gaza, so-called Israel, and the West Bank. There's more Palestinian Arabs than there is Jewish people. So the demographic will continue to grow. I personally think eventually there's going to be one state. If the Israelis are going to maintain this sort of this so-called democracy that they say and give people voting rights, then they're going to have a Palestinian government voted in because there's going to be more Palestinians living there. So I see this coming to a close. Sort of in a way of the demographics changing, but I think there's going to be a lot of ongoing violence, and people need to stand up, and people need to, if they can, go there and pay a lot of attention to this. And everything Israel is doing in the region, all of its aims, all of the projects is carrying out against all the different neighboring countries, this is all connected. It's all one big project for greater Israel, and it's always been this way. And they have a very, very powerful lobby group which coerces governments worldwide and owns foreign policies. And that's the reason why they're able to get away with it. It's called AIPAC. I'm sure many people listening to this are familiar with AIPAC. But combating this, combating the aid it gets, is the way to go. But I think that the Palestinians are going to take it back. The Arabs are going to take it back. They've formed a very strong alliance, an axis of resistance, if you will, against the state of Israel. They're becoming stronger, they're fighting back, and the demographics are changing. So I think the state of Israel and its criminality and the days of it being able to operate and kill people and take land with impunity is coming to a close. But I think this needs to be on the terms of the Palestinian people, not these so-called Western activists that try and make themselves, you know, the ones that can tell the Palestinians what to do. We can't tell them. They're the Palestinians. It's their land, and this is their country. Like the Syrians, we're not going to try and tell the Syrians what to do, are we? We want the Syrians to determine their own future because they're a sovereign people and they deserve rights like everybody else in the world. So I suppose that's a little bit of a summary of all of that.
Mm-hmm. And what do you recommend, you know, if someone wants to get involved? I know there's a lot of opportunities with regards in the West Bank to coming out, you know, helping with the olive harvest, for instance. So sometimes the farmers have found if there's, you know, people, international observers or volunteers there, the settlers are less likely to fire on the farmers as they're trying to harvest their olive trees. There's programs through churches, through the YMCA. If anyone's listening that was interested and they wanted to kind of get on that road, where would be a good starting point?
Well, I mean, I just booked a flight over. I had Palestinian friends and I decided to stay there for 3 months last year. So, I mean, going there is the most essential thing for anybody that wants to, one, understand it fully, and two, you'll have your own personal stories. You'll know a lot of people and you're going to be able to speak with absolute authority on the subject once you've seen it with your own eyes. I mean, it's very essential that people go there, take their videos, get to know Palestinian people. And, you know, we can't violently resist like, say, Palestinians could. We can't do anything against the occupation forces or whatnot. That's not our struggle. Our struggle is to support the Palestinians and facilitate them having their rights granted back to them and their fight and their struggle for their justice. And, I mean, BDS is a good thing to support. Boycotting Israeli goods. I mean, I would not buy anything from that is produced in so-called Israel. I've seen the settlements and how they harvest the date farms that they stole originally from Palestinians. And I've seen them steal, they've been stealing the water from the aqua filters. Like, you know, if you go there, it gets a lot more personal for you. You will see it. You'll be able to put these videos online. It's very essential. And like you said, there's a lot of good groups that are doing great work on the ground and documenting this. I mean, if it's the difference between a child getting beaten up or a Palestinian being shot by a settler or a soldier and not if there's a Western person there because they don't like the bad PR. And they won't shoot a Western person most of the time either. So you can, you know, you can be there and you can sort of act in a way to protect these people. If you don't want to do that, then going there at least is a great start. I mean, if you really want to get involved. If not, offering your support to people who are reporting that and who are doing that, and to Palestinians who are doing that, and getting this out there for them. I mean, the truth is the most valuable weapon of the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, good advice all the way around. We'll wrap up this segment, but we want to thank you, Robert, for your work. Robert Inlakesh, check him out. We've got a link to his social media pages here on the show page. You can go and see his work. You're also live streaming, aren't you, Robert, periodically on issues. Yeah. And almazdarnews.com, great website. You're writing there as well. So check out Robert's work. Thank you very much for your hard work and dedication, Robert. And we hope to speak to you again on these issues as it breaks. We'll hope to get in touch with you for a heads up on some of these issues.
Thank you.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. It's Robert Inlakesh. He's joining us on the live link. We're talking about Palestine. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back for the final segment, for the final statement. We've got a few things to share with you, which you just might want to hear. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. This is the Sunday Wire. Stick around. Tune in Sundays at noon Eastern Time or 9 a.m. Pacific Time for the Sunday Wire for 3 hours of action-packed talk radio on 21stCenturyWire.com and AlternateCurrentRadio.com.